plastics machinery. We have, according to my lineup, Ms. Hansen representing Image Plastics Federated for 15 minutes. Mr. Ritchie for 25 minutes. And then you have a 15 minutes rebuttal and then a 5 minutes rebuttal. This is on the cross petitions. Okay. Ms. Hansen.
May it please the court. My name is Laura Hansen, and I represent the defendants, appellants, petitioners, Image Plastics and Federated Mutual Insurance Company. The first issue before this court this morning is whether an unnegotiated indemnity term on the back of a sales order for the sale of goods is valid under Wisconsin law. My clients, Image Plastics and Federated, contend that it is invalid and should be struck down for two reasons. First, that it violates Wisconsin's rule, which prohibits a manufacturer from delegating its duty to design and manufacture a reasonably safe product. And second, that the provision is unconscionable because it does not provide sufficient notice of the provision and it's inconspicuous.
Would it have made a difference if it had been on the front in boldface type? In other words, you're saying unnegotiated, there's an assumption that you read it. You know, you read the contract, but you seem to say that there was no notice of it. Therefore, it was just positioned wrong?
Well, it's a combination of the fact that it's positioned wrong and that it is also in lowercase.
So then there's an assumption that had it been on the front, it would have been acceptable because it would have been noticed by your client?
I believe, Your Honor, also that it should have been featured in capital letters, like the warranty disclaimer is featured on the backside of the agreement.
So you think that would have made a difference if it would have been in caps on the front, then it would be, you're not accepting it as necessarily valid, but would have certainly given notice to your client.
I believe that the conspicuousness concern that I have would be satisfied by that. And then in terms of whether or not it's unconscionable, I think we would still have to look at all of the factors. But yes, Your Honor.
So this is an unconscionable argument, not that there is no contract argument.
That's correct.
The Court of Appeals dealt with the contract argument, held it was a contract, there was a meeting of the minds, etc. And then the question is whether this contract is unconscionable under either procedural or substantive grounds. Procedural is placement and notice, substantive is the essence of it, right?
That's correct.
That's your argument?
That and the delegation of duty.
Okay.
Right.
What about the substantive unconscionability argument?
Well, when you look at the actual commercial reasonableness of the terms, our position is that under Wisconsin law, there are not indemnity provisions that have been upheld in the product's liability context. Instead, what Wisconsin law provides is that an indemnity can provide that it be indemnified for its own negligence. But those provisions are to be strictly construed. And the cases that we have in Wisconsin that involve that kind of a provision are actually outside of the product's liability context.
Well, there is a negligence cause of action here. This happened to go off on the strict liability. So if you should even win on that, can't you just go back and be sued for negligence and... on that doctrine, and that is the Arlington's negligence, and that you're indemnifying them? I mean, does that win you the day?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Can you ultimately win on that argument here, or don't you get another trial on the negligence doctrine?
But with respect to negligence, Your Honor, it's our position that this provision, if it's unconscionable, is unconscionable for both strict liability purposes and for negligence purposes. It isn't just that there are no strict liability cases in Wisconsin. It's also that when you look at the negligence cases, they're quite different than what we have here. We often see the indemnity kind of agreements in the construction context, which makes some sense. There are layers of contracts and layers of indemnity. In this scenario, we have a provision on the backside of a sales order, and I submit that there isn't a case in Wisconsin, or in Illinois for that matter, that addresses the conspicuousness or the unconscionability factors in the context of a transaction like this. An individual seller selling a product to a buyer with a one-page sales contract with all the provisions on the backside.
Explain to me how you distinguish then the building situation with the multi-layers contractors. If in the general to the sub, to the sub, 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 there would be some agreement, but on the back side it's in small print. Is there a difference between this transaction and the transactions that occur in the building industry that make a legal difference?
Well, I think they do, because the Uniform Commercial Code controls the sale of goods, and we are concerned about special protections for buyers in the context of the sale of goods. And that's why, for example, we require conspicuousness in connection with the disclaimer of warranties in terms of the sales contracts that are issued in the sale of goods. And it's our position that if you apply the Wisconsin common law with respect to unconscionability, that it would also require conspicuousness here. Now, the case law on that sort of issue, conspicuousness in Wisconsin, tends to be in the exculpatory context. Those are contracts such as the Yauger case, where we're dealing with ski exculpatory contracts in that sort of situation. But if you apply the same principle here, this is like that situation. If you apply the rule here under these facts, we've got a provision in lowercase print on the backside of a sales order, and Wisconsin law, applying the rule that we apply in exculpatory contracts here, would strike down the provision as inconspicuous. And of course, inconspicuous is considered when we're looking at the procedural factors related to unconscionability. If you look at the Discount Fabrics case of this court, and then the Lease First case which followed, in Lease First, the provision where the parties elected a choice of law forum for the litigation of the case was struck down, and one of the factors that was considered by the Lease First court was the fact that it was in small print and not a provision that had been brought to the notice of the buyer, the other party to the contract.
Well, here, isn't this, I'm just trying to think, this is something put into the stream of commerce. I assume that there are other manufacturers that make this product. So basically, you needed a product, you went and you bought something as is, or at least that's what I'm assuming. It's like, you're taking it as it is, and we're not going to be liable, so you inspect the machine. As I look at the facts, you inspected the machine, took it back, used it, and then, of course, the incident happened. But what you seem to be saying, that if this was on the front of the document, then it would have made a big difference, because you would have had, but isn't there an assumption in a two-page document, you read both sides?
Well, the provision on the bottom of the front page of the document did, in fairness, did direct the buyer to the reverse side of the document. And Mr. Harm testified that he flipped the document over and looked. He did not read it carefully and understood it to be a standard type contract where he takes a product in as-is condition. And had the provision been featured on the front that he was undertaking all liability for any injury or loss associated with this product, not only while he owned it, but for any subsequent purchaser down the line, I think it would have made a big difference in how he approached the transaction had he seen that on the front side of the sales order.
Ms. Hanson, isn't this a very different situation than Yalger? You were indicating earlier that you thought that was a case that was applicable here. And my recollection of Yalger was, first of all, that the time frame was very different. It was someone who was buying a ski ticket. They were going on a ski hill. Here, your client has plenty of time to sit and read over this two-page document, the front side and the back side. Beyond that, my recollection of Yalger is that Yalger was a case where there was some confusion in regard to the provision. In other words, the provision itself was not very clear. You don't have that situation here. It looks like the provision is crystal clear in regard to the responsibilities that your client would be taking on. So how do you rely on Yalger? What is it about Yalger that you think helps you in this case?
The Yalger case approved a commentary citing the Dresser case in Texas. And that commentary discussing the Dresser case talked about a situation where, not just in this exculpatory clause context, but also in the context of indemnity provisions, that it's important that an indemnity provision be brought to the attention of the purchaser or buyer. That was in the commentary and was cited with approval by this court. So I think the point in citing the Yalger case is, granted this is not an exculpatory clause context, but that there was some recognition by this court in Yalger that the commentary on the Dresser, Texas case went far beyond the exculpatory context.
Seems to me your strongest argument, and the tough part of it, is that this indemnification is just contrary to public policy. That unless you hold the line of the manufacturer or the seller, he's the seller of used merchandise, unless you sell hold that seller liable, then there'll be no incentive on the seller to check out the machinery and make sure that it is reasonably safe. And that if we say Arlington can shuffle off this liability to the buyer, the consumer, here is a corporate consumer, that is contrary to public policy. You have to hold everybody's feet to the fire. And that, especially the seller, and that's why it's unconscionable. Now, is that your argument?
You summarized it fairly. I think what the problem is, and where we had the problem in the Court of Appeals, is that the Court of Appeals relied on this court's decision in Dykstra to hold that it really isn't a delegation of duty, but it's just a shifting of financial responsibility, and obviously we take issue with that. If you look at the full context of this whole transaction, and you look at the entire contract, if you look at that backside, what you see is something much greater than a mere shifting of financial responsibility. The Dykstra case, as you'll recall, is a safe place statute case. The general contractor was indemnified by the subcontractor, and the court ruled that, well, this isn't delegating the safe place statute, it's just shifting financial responsibility for the loss. And the factors that it considered were the fact that the general contractor actually paid the plaintiff, had the means to pay the plaintiff. The court noted that it had presumably purchased insurance for the safe place statute obligation. It stated that the safe place workplace requirement was best controlled by the party that was on the front line, the subcontractor. Here, on the other hand, this really is a delegation of duty. Arlington is in the better position to control the safe product. The first underlying complaint is a complaint for failure to properly design this product.
Why? The purpose, of course, is to ensure the safe manufacture of goods. And it seems to me that when Arlington here shifts the cost of any liability to somebody else, they are doing so at a cost to themselves. Now, for instance, they get less for their product. And so it seems to me that at least the argument is that since they could avoid, they could get more for their product if they kept the responsibility, and they get less for their product if they shift the responsibility for indemnity, that in and of itself is sufficient to guarantee the safe manufacture of the goods, or at least provide a compelling motive to Arlington or somebody like Arlington to manufacture safe products. How do you answer that?
Well, Your Honor, that simply isn't the fact scenario here. I think the only testimony that it was lower priced is because it was used as opposed to new. There's no testimony that Greg Harm, in purchasing it, knew that it was less expensive because it carried with it all the obligation to make sure that it's used safely in the workplace, and that any subsequent user or purchaser would also be responsible to them.
I know there's nothing in this record to substantiate that, but I'm taking it as sort of presuming that they would have gotten more for their product if they hadn't been able to, or at least somebody like Arlington would have gotten more for their product. That in fact there was a price somewhere along the line to pay for this shift.
But the focus shouldn't be on which party it is that purchased insurance for the product. In fact, that's the argument that's been made by Dominski. What Dominski contends is that it's really no different than if they had purchased insurance. Instead, what they did was they spread the cost this way. They sent it on down to the purchaser of the product. And who cares anyway, because he had insurance for it. Nowhere in Wisconsin do we determine the validity of an indemnity provision based on where the best insurance lies. Instead, what the court has said, because strict liability is so important and producing reasonably safe products is so important, is that what we have to do is make sure the incentives exist where they belong, and the party who controls the product and the proper design and manufacture of that product should have the ultimate responsibility. And if you can offload that on the backside of a sales order, then we've got a problem.
Could I ask, is Arlington the original manufacturer of this machine?
No.
It was a used equipment that it sold.
Was it?
Then why should Arlington be treated the same as an original manufacturer?
They weren't just an intermediate seller or distributor. They actually refurbished the product and indeed designed the guard system that's on the product. The original complaint by Dominski against Arlington alone was for defective design of the product, the essence of a strict liability claim.
So in your view, they really should be viewed as an original manufacturer?
That's correct, Your Honor. Under the context of the claim here.
And that's cases we've had on used equipment for refurbishing, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, we allow a manufacturer to insure, correct?
That's correct.
They can insure it. Why doesn't that remove the incentive then to manufacture a safe product?
Because the insurance premium is controlled by your claim history. You're not going to be able to get repeat insurance or renewal insurance if you had a bad claim history and you don't care whether or not your product is safe. It's a little bit different than completely offloading responsibility for the product to the next purchaser.
Thank you. Mr. Ritchie?
Your Honor.
morning. My name is John Ritchie. I'm from the Ritchie Wixterman Wachs Law Firm in Eau Claire with co-counsel Ray Hull from Hull Law Office in Cornell. We represent Todd Dominski, the plaintiff, respondent, and petitioner, co-petitioner in the Supreme Court. For my arguments today, what I'd like to do is, first of all, address counsel's comments regarding the validity of whether the duty to defend clause is even a valid and enforceable agreement. And in the second part of my comments, talk about that if it is a valid clause, what happens, what are the consequences when a merchant breaches that duty to defend? First and foremost, to begin looking at the validity of the clause, is that something that's been totally skipped in counsel's arguments earlier this morning is the fact that we have a written signed contract that says that it will be governed by the laws of Illinois. Wisconsin permits people to choose the law under which they will be governed. In this case, the written contract does say that it will be governed by the laws of Illinois. And in fact, this is a Wisconsin merchant that drove to Illinois, negotiated a contract in Illinois, paid for the goods by sending the money to Illinois, and took ownership of the product in Illinois, and then on its own had the product shifted back to Wisconsin. So the Illinois law should be the governing law of this contract.
Counsel, do you know if Illinois has adopted the restatement of torts? I'm looking at section 18 in the restatement of law of torts, product liability. That is, and it reads as follows, the comment reads as follows, a commercial seller or other distributor of a new product is not permitted to avoid liability for harm to persons through limiting terms in a contract governing the sale of a contract. Do you know if Illinois has adopted the comment to section 18?
I do not.
If the idea, I think, behind section 18 and the comment is products liability is different than negligence. And product strict liability, no need to show acts of negligence. And the import is to have safe products for the ultimate consumer or user of the product. I'm at least concerned, I'm not sure I'm persuaded, but I'm concerned by the argument of your opposing counsel that it's consistent with this comment, to relieve the manufacturer of liability serves as a disincentive to create safe products, which would be against public policy. Can you respond to that?
That's not what strict liability does, and that's not what strict liability, I believe, was ever intended. Certainly, strict liability was designed so that plaintiffs will have an easier opportunity to make a claim against the person who made the machine. In the olden days, you had to prove negligence, which meant you had to prove fault. And lots of times you couldn't prove fault, even though the machine was admittedly dangerous. Plaintiff would lose. Under strict liability, all you have to do is prove that it was an unreasonably dangerous machine. Even though you can't prove fault, you have the right to make a recovery.
Those specific acts of negligence are necessary to be proven.
So that when you have a obligation or whether you're going to make a safe product, you don't, the manufacturer is still on the hook either way. They are not delegating their responsibility to someone else. The question then is, I hope I don't lose track of the question. But
I look at it as behavior modification 101. And I don't care if you're applying it to some huge manufacturer of a multi-billion dollar corporation or to a first grader at Hawthorne Middle School, Hawthorne Elementary School. If there aren't consequences for the behavior isn't going to change. That's what I call behavior 101. I don't care who you apply it to. You can apply it to me. So the argument is, if a manufacturer of a product can not be held accountable financially, isn't that against public policy of having safe products on the market? Because if there's no sting, if there's no consequence, if there's no time out, they're going to look at the bottom line dollar. How can we make the cheapest product and get the highest profit and let someone else take care of the payment of the liability exposure?
First of all, I think that would be an unrealistic view of how the world works. But second of all, is that...
What part is unrealistic? That they're in it for profit?
What?
That they're in it for profit?
Well, they're in it for profit, but in this case, Arlington is on the hook to Dominski. Whether they are going to lose their shirt in this case depends upon whether or not Image can come in and save them. We don't know. I don't know if there's any evidence to show that Image had the financial wherewithal that they were going to be the white knight. If Image doesn't have any assets, then that indemnity agreement isn't worth the paper that it's written on. In that case, Arlington would still lose its shirt, so they're very much at risk.
Currently, Arlington doesn't have a shirt to lose, though. That's
well, but they're still true, but we can say that about a lot of people who don't have a lot of assets. But if we're looking at behavior management, that would mean that strike down all insurance policies.
Take a multi-billion dollar corporation instead of Arlington, and this same fact situation, does that make any difference to you?
Then, if you said that they can't have such a clause because it would change their way of evaluating their product, what they would become is a self-insurer. And so then everybody is going to have to factor in what is the risk that their product makes and somehow go through the insurance analysis within their own industry, which I believe probably some very large corporations do. And through that factoring in, look at the risk and then factor in a self-insured factor now into your product.
I'm missing the self-insured. Maybe I wasn't clear. You have a multi-billion dollar corporation called Arlington, and yet when they sell products, they have a limitation of liability indemnification agreement with a company like Image, who's insured. And you know, mom and pop, I don't mean disrespectful, but smaller, you know, than a multi-billion dollar corporation. You know, well, there's no argument that it's a disincentive to make safe products.
But see, in that case, if you said, let's make an unsafe product because we can make it on the cheap and have more profit.
You have someone else pay for it.
Maybe someone else will pay for it. But do you want to take that risk?
I suggest if it was a multi-millionaire corporation, you would have not settled with them and let them off the hook.
I'm sorry, can you...
You would not have entered into an agreement with a sound financial Arlington to let them, to release them from payment.
Well, that would be the second part of the issues here today.
Well, the point being that under an indemnity provision, Arlington is always liable to the injured party if liability is proved. The fact that Arlington can then might recover from someone else still puts Arlington at great risk under the indemnity provision. Image could be bankrupt, right?
I'm sorry, but I'm having a hard time with the echo, but Arlington?
Arlington, under the indemnity provision, does not lose liability to Dominski. That is, Arlington remains liable.
Correct.
Arlington, if it paid Dominski, then would go after Image.
Yes.
And that's risky because Image might not have the money.
Right.
So the question then as to whether or not Arlington would be more negligent knowing it has an indemnity provision has to take that into account. The problem in this case is Arlington was released not by Image, but or even by Arlington, but by Dominski.
But that goes not to whether the clause is valid.
Well, I suggest it may go to the public policy doctrine, too.
Well, the public,
you don't have to accept that.
If we look at the policy of whether, then, what do you do when you tender the defense, when you have a contractual merchant, a merchant that contractually agrees that they will defend, and following the contract, the merchant tenders the defense to Image. That is putting Images in a fiduciary relationship. This court has held that when you have a duty to defend, you have the right to control litigation, which creates a fiduciary responsibility. Now, that's come up mostly with insurance companies, but what we're dealing with is the same clause that created a fiduciary responsibility for an insurer. Why would that not be a fiduciary responsibility when we're talking about another commercial merchant? When you tender the defense and the defense is refused, now the indemnity is put in a box about what are they supposed to do. They are not having the defense paid for them as was bargained for or agreed to in the contract. Illinois has looked at that. In Illinois, which has a great deal of commercial contract law, says if you tender the defense, it's just like an insurance company. You do it at your own risk. The time to contest the issue is when things are tendered. If you don't tender, liability is absolutely concluded, and the indemnity is free to settle the case. And they will... That settlement will be binding on the indemnitor unless the indemnitor moves to set it aside by showing fraud or collusion or some other illegal means. Now, that makes sound policy, I believe, because it gives the incentive to the indemnitor to pick up the defense. In Wisconsin, we have not evolved to answering that question yet. We have the Barron's decision, which was decided in 1979, which suggests very much the same thing, in that if you tender the defense in a commercial contract, then you have to pick it up or you will have breached the duty to defend. But what are the consequences when you breach that duty to defend? The Barron's decisions suggest that you would have some sort of hearing in front of the court to say you're going to be bound if you can show that you had potential liability and that the settlement was reasonable. What Barron's doesn't say is, how do you do that? Do you have a whole trial just as if you were retrying the underlying case? Because if that's the case, then I think that creates poor public policy because the indemnitor has now no disincentive for violating their contract, except they come in knowing that the cap, they're going to be limited to the cap that you settled for, and now they're free to try and litigate the case down. Because if you say a jury should decide what's potential liability, the jury may say, I don't know if you have potential liability until you first instruct me how liability is judged in the underlying case. And is the settlement reasonable? I don't know that until you tell me how liability is judged in the underlying case. And indemnitors using that would want to have a whole new trial, just changing the verdict questions, but having a whole new trial. And so it appears that we have the Barron's case that left that somewhat unanswered, but it was followed up by a string of insurance cases that dealt with breaches and duty to defend. We have the Newhouse case, we have the Radke case, and a string of cases along that line that says if you have a duty to defend and you breach that duty to defend, then you will pay all the consequences which naturally flow from that breach, which automatically includes paying the settlement. Now, I don't know if Wisconsin intended that there be two separate tracks, one for a breach of duty by an insurance company, one for a breach of duty to defend by commercial merchants. I would suggest that it probably was never intended that there be two separate tracks. It's just that Barron's was decided in 1979 before the stronger body of law evolved in insurance. But Barron's seems to have just dropped off the radar screen after it was decided, because there hasn't been any real commercial cases decided outside of the insurance world. So what I would suggest is that when dealing with whether or not this is a valid or how we are going to enforce that, we would say, number one, Illinois got it right. They've had it for several years. That the indemnitor better pick up the defense, just like an insurance company, when the defense is tendered. And if you don't, you will be held to pay the settlement unless you can show that it was by fraud or collusion, but the burden on that would be on the indemnitor.
Well, is that another way of saying that the burden on image, if it goes back, you say, is to show that it was an unreasonable settlement?
Well, Illinois doesn't use unreasonable. Barron's uses the words,
right,
whether it was reasonable, but it's not clear who's got the burden of proving what.
Of proving what?
Barron's doesn't explain to us or give us any guidance as to who's got the burden when we go back to prove potential liability. It implies that the burden is still on the indemnity. They would have to...
On you?
Right. That we would have to prove that we had potential liability and that the settlement was reasonable. That's fine, but the question then becomes, what kind of hearing is being contemplated? It would make sense to say you do not get a full-blown trial, Mr. Indemnitor, because you blew that chance. We may have an abbreviated hearing, much like the Rhymes hearing on subrogation cases, where, you know, would the plaintiff have been made whole? The trial court judge would hear that and rule as to whether the person has been made whole or not, and whether the subrogation claim is extinguished. I could foresee a case where this is remanded to the trial court judge to decide whether there is potential liability and whether the settlement is reasonable. But if we're to say we're going to go back and have a whole jury trial on that issue,
well, I assume that you would want the burden to be on image.
I would love that.
The settlement was unreasonable.
I would love that, but I guess what we need is that's, since they breached the contract, that is an issue as to where the burden would lie, but there's nothing that I can find that shows who's other than Barron's.
Why do you think they should have the burden?
Because if they're found to have breached the contract in the first instance, then they are the ones who created this problem for the indemnity by breaching a fiduciary responsibility.
But is there any room in this whole scenario for the indemnitor to litigate the enforceability of the indemnification agreement? You're having trouble with the sound, I'm sorry. So are we. The issue of the enforceability of the indemnification agreement, isn't that capable of being litigated in this whole procedure? My understanding of the facts is that on the day that the tender was rejected, the settlement was entered into.
No, that's not true. The settlement came several months later. This was tendered in about... in February, the rejection came in like April or June, May, June, the settlement was that fall.
And what was the status of the litigation of the enforceability of the indemnification agreement?
There was none, because Arlington, who had that claim, had not made any, they had not brought a third-party complaint against Image. What they did was litigate the underlying case to the point where they knew that they were in serious trouble with all of the depositions and the medical records and expert review and all of that. And at that point, then they were offered a settlement by Dominski, which contemplated getting this approved by the trial court judge, and that Dominski would then take the indemnification claim and enforce it. And that was submitted to the trial court for its review and approval. And the trial court found that that was an appropriate way to handle it. So Arlington did not bring an enforcement action.
Well, who impleaded Image?
What?
Who impleaded Image and when?
Who impleaded it? I impleaded. Dominski impleaded Image eventually.
Eventually. And what happened when there was a settlement reached? Was that the same day that an answer was filed by Image?
Well, we did have two different patterns going on, because we'd been in suit with Arlington for a year, and I then impleaded Image under the theory that this indemnification agreement may constitute an insurance policy. And if it does, then Dominski would have, under the direct action statute, a right to make a claim against the insurer. That's the theory under which they were impleaded, which when they claimed that their answer came in. So that the settlement was with Arlington was going on at the same time that Dominski, entirely independent of that, was bringing an amended complaint to bring in Image on a separate theory.
When did Image answer and assert its argument that the agreement was unenforceable?
Well, we had a couple different amended complaints that came in. First, we amended to include a direct action against Image. And then subsequent to that, we amended, and again, to take over the assignment of the indemnification claim. And I believe the original responsive pleadings argued that workers' compensation barred such a claim. So it has been contested as being invalid from when it was first tendered. When Arlington first tendered the defense to Image, Image tendered it to Federated, and Federated wrote a response to that tender on behalf of both Federated and Image, where they said, we think this is an invalid clause and we're not going to adhere to it. And if you intend to sue it on it, we intend to contest it till we get to the Supreme Court. So it was contested as being an invalid provision from day one.
The settlement was 1.4 something million dollars. Where did that figure come from? And was it litigated at all?
It was negotiated. I mean, the original suggestion by us was significantly higher than that. Arlington was suggesting lower figures, and then the question which was raised was, if we take an assignment, is that going to be a valid settlement? So number one, we know that under Illinois law it is. They permit that type of settlement because the indemnity typically isn't going to have the kind of money if they don't have the backing of the indemnitor. So that we took it then to the trial court judge, submitted it with our evidence of damages to him.
When did Image know about the 1.4?
After they were impled, or by the time they were into the lawsuit, the settlement had been consummated.
Let me me ask this again. Did Image know about the $1.4 million before the settlement?
No.
Were they involved in the settlement?
No. Since they had already said that they weren't going to pick up the defense and they challenged the validity of the clause.
Well, what in purpose, I think, of this line of questioning, and my purpose is the same if it is to determine what motivation.
Make a reasonable settlement.
Arlington had to settle for a reasonable figure. So the specific question I have is, what if Image went belly up subsequently and was unable to pay? Would Arlington be liable for the for that negotiated settlement?
No. Well, they've transferred whatever they got out of that to Dominski, so Dominski might be stuck with an agreement that he can't enforce against anybody. So there was a calculated risk by Dominski.
So what motivation is there on the behalf of Arlington to negotiate a reasonable settlement?
Well, number one is that's why we took it to the court for court approval, so that we would have the court review the damages and see whether it's reasonable. Because that's, under Illinois law, you have the right to do that. But I was concerned, and everybody's concerned, that challenge might come up, so let's get the court to review it. Second thing is that if we follow a Barron's decision and we have a remand for a hearing to determine whether it's reasonable, somehow somebody is going to have to determine that, and whether it's, if it's paid or whether it's not paid, the settlement, you might say the incentive is different, but the end result to who's ever judging this would not be based on whether it's paid or whether it's unpaid. It would be based on what was the liability and what were the damages. For example, if someone was to say they have no incentive to negotiate a lower settlement, so that makes it unreasonable, what if we then came in and said, oh, surprise, they did pay it? Then you would say, oh, well, then we'll have to change our opinion, given the same liability and the same damages. So that the issue of how do you pay it is always going to be stuck to the indemnity, in this case, Arlington, who doesn't have the cash. They're offered an opportunity to settle the case at a figure that, in their opinion, is reasonable, in which the trial court determines reasonable. What other option are they supposed to follow when their fiduciary won't pick up their fiduciary responsibility to defend them?
Mr. Ritchie, did the trial court actually make a determination that there was potential liability and that this was a reasonable settlement?
No, they didn't put it in those terms, which would be parroting the Barron's decision. What we did was we put together a stipulation as to what the issues were, what the damages were, and how we proposed to settle the case. That we proposed that we would be stipulating to a judgment, that we would be assigning the judgment from Arlington to Dominski, that Dominski would only execute as they can through the assignment, and that the risk then goes with Dominski as to whether that's going to be worth anything. But and then we gave the medical records and medical reports and expert reports on liability to the judge. And the judge issued an order that said, I find that the settlement is reasonable. So that's what led to us then consummating the settlement and then including Dominski making the claim against.
Well, do you concede at this point that based on either Illinois law or Wisconsin law or both, that there should be a remand if we find for you to the trial court for further findings?
If it's based on Illinois law, then the liability would be determined and damages would be set unless Image had moved to set it aside based on fraud or collusion, which they never have done. If we follow insurance rule of law, it would seem to say that they automatically pay, because they breached the duty to defend, that you pay the damages which naturally flow, which under Radke says is paying the settlement. And if we follow Barron's, then Barron's suggests that we go back for some sort of hearing to determine whether there's potential liability and whether the settlement is reasonable. And how that's going to be determined is something that this court is going to have to decide, whether it's a Rhymes-like abbreviated hearing or something else. But that's the course that I would expect that we follow under Barron's. So under Illinois law, it would be done. Under Wisconsin law, there would probably be a remand.
But in any case, you're opposing the idea that the Court of Appeals position took, that you'd have to go back for a trial now on liability and on damages, a jury trial perhaps.
That would be, I think, the absolute worst public policy, because all that does is tell every indemnitor, when you get tendered the defense, turn it down. Let them settle, and then you can still go have a trial later on. Only you know that the damages are capped at 1.4. So if a jury comes in and says, it's really bad, it's worth $2 million, they would say, great, we only pay 1.4. So they have a free kick at the cat then by turning it down to try and mitigate the things lower. And then we would never have the public policy of trying to encourage people to pick up the defense that they had contracted to would be totally thrown out the window.
I know the red light is on, but I do need a clarification of the chronology here. The settlement was entered into, and the hearing to approve the settlement was held before Image was brought into the case.
We had filed the amended complaint, naming them as an insurance company, a de facto insurance company. That amended complaint, first we started out against Arlington only, did all of the discovery. The defense was tendered to Arlington and rejected by Arlington, to Image. We then filed an amended complaint which alleged that Image, through this contract, is in effect an insurance company, and that the direct action statute ought to allow us to make a claim against them as an insurance company. That complaint was filed and served. When the settlement had been, when the parallel settlement had been made with Arlington, so that Arlington's settlement with Dominski occurred simultaneously with, I believe, the same day that the answer came in.
Was the hearing held, though, before Image? When was the hearing held? Image appeared?
There was not a hearing. The court didn't require a hearing. We submitted it on paper with a settlement package about what the, we submitted all the photographs and medical records and reports, and the court signed.
After Image had been served with the copy of the amended complaint completing Image, but before it had answered? So Image
yes.
had
well, we had sent it to the court, and I think that their answer came in, was eventually mailed to the court on the same day that the court...
That's the same day issue that I was trying to get to earlier, and I think that's critical here. As I understand the facts, Image never had any opportunity to participate in the court's finding of, or approval of the settlement here. And doesn't that make a difference here? I mean, wouldn't the indemnitor be considered an indispensable party to any decision on a settlement that it's going to have to pay?
And my answer to that is no, and here's why. If you're tendered the defense, you have the opportunity to pick it up and control it. The other option that Arlington had was to say to Image, yes, we have the right to tender this defense to you, But we think we're better able to defend it ourselves. We would rather have our own attorneys because we're experts in this area, even though we could tender it to Image. So we'll continue our own defense. And in that situation, Arlington could say, okay, we're defending ourselves, but we want to settle the case. Image has never been involved yet, so then you would have to involve Image to approve the settlement because they've never had any chance to be involved. But here they've took the reverse option, which is to say, Image, please come in. We don't want to defend ourselves. We want you to control the litigation, and we want you to control the settlement stuff when we tender the defense to you.
But doesn't Image have the right as the indemnitor to say, you know, we don't think this is an enforceable indemnification agreement, sue us. And then it would have an opportunity, after it's been sued, to litigate the issue of the enforceability of the indemnification clause. Your argument is that it takes that the case is going to be settled out from under them when they're not even in the lawsuit yet.
Well, except you're saying it's settled out from under them as if they never had a chance to be in the case. The case was tendered to them, and they said, get lost. We're not going to defend you. You're on your own. So that, because what you're suggesting would mean, no, we're going to breach our contract. And
everybody's got a right to breach their contract.
And because of our wrongful conduct, ha ha ha, now you have no right because you should have sued me sooner than you did.
So is it under Newhouse that you're saying, all right, once you tender it, I assume, then that responsibility then shifted to Image to get in the ballgame and have some control, and since they chose not to do that, then they accept the they have the ultimate responsibility for whatever came out of the resolution. So.
Exactly, and I think the Uniform Code is set up to address that. Section 401-207 talks about how you can pick up the defense under a reservation of rights under the Uniform Commercial Code. And so that whether it's a merchant-to-merchant or insurance company, which is also a merchant, either way, if you have a contract that provides a duty to defense, then I suggest that the ramifications should be the same, which is what we have under Newhouse. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Richie. Ms. Hanson, you have 15 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. To first address the timing issue, this lawsuit was started, Dominski versus Arlington, May of 1998. Arlington tendered the defense to Image over a year later, June of 1999. The letter reserving rights and indicating that it would not pay defense costs on an ongoing basis, what he calls the rejection of the tender, occurred in July of 1999, a month later. At that time, the amended complaint was filed against Image and Federated as Image's liability insurer. In August, the deal was struck, the settlement was made, and the same day that the answer was due to the amended complaint, the order was signed by the court. There was no hearing on the reasonableness of the settlement. It was sent as a proposed order, which was signed by Judge Brunner in the Circuit Court. The trouble I have with all of this discussion about a Barron's hearing is that there aren't any Barron's hearings in Wisconsin, and even Barron's wasn't a Barron's hearing. It was a trial. In Barron's, when U.S. Steel sued Remke, the subcontractor, they had a trial of the indemnity action. It happened to be a bench trial because they stipulated to the facts. And indeed, Renke didn't even object that $75,000 was a reasonable settlement. So it was a trial. It just so happened they agreed on a lot of the issues. All right? So when we talk about remanding this matter for a Behrens-type hearing, there is no such thing. Behrens was a trial.
Unlike a stipulation here.
Right, as a result of the stipulation, absolutely. Now, the most important distinction about Behrens, of course, is that it was a case where there was absolutely nothing. It was not like this case because there was something at risk. It was an arm's length negotiation. What we have here with Arlington is a confession of judgment. No incentive to get the best possible deal, nothing at risk.
And slightly less than policy limits.
Pardon me?
At something slightly less than policy limits.
Right. $25,000 less than the $1.5 million policy limits that Federated had for Image. There is a Wisconsin case, the Finch case. The Illinois case, the Finch case, that is cited in tandem with Behrens by the plaintiff here to establish that under Illinois law you don't need a Behrens hearing, under Behrens you need a Behrens hearing. But in both of those cases, the indemnity actually paid the settlement amount to the injured party and then pursued. Now, what the plaintiff says about that is whether it's paid or not paid isn't the issue. But what really is the issue is what's at risk. If Arlington settled this case for $1.475 million and was unsuccessful in pursuing Image for indemnity, if it actually paid that sum, there would be something at risk. Or if it had a judgment entered against it, hadn't yet paid it, but it was a judgment that was either going to send it into bankruptcy or one that could be enforced against it, it would have something at risk. But what Arlington has here is a judgment that says, I'll never enforce it against you. So what incentive do they have? Let's pick a number. It happens to be within policy limits, but we picked a number. So now what we have is a settlement that was not the product of an arm's length negotiation, and under Behrens, it was important that the indemnitor be given an opportunity to participate in the settlement. And as we've discussed at length this morning, that didn't occur here.
Well, what do you want then? Assuming for the moment, but not binding you, this is found to be a valid indemnification agreement. If it's not valid, then everything else falls. Okay. It is valid. So the issue then comes, what do you do with this judgment, and what's the effect on Image, right? You're not a party to the judgment. You're not represented there. You didn't even know about it. Now, okay, how should you be bound by it, even assuming you've got a valid indemnification agreement? Isn't that the issue on this cross appeal?
Right. What we contend.
Yeah. What do you want to do?
What the Court of Appeals ruled, which is we remand this case for a full liability, a full trial on liability and damages.
Where does the Court of Appeals say that? And your position is you're not bound by anything that happened, that issue preclusion?
Right. With the court, I think the reason the court addressed issue preclusion is because Dominski contended that we don't get to relitigate fault and damages. And so as a result, the court looked to the law of issue preclusion, went to the restatement, which says if the judgment is obtained by confession, consent, or default, no issue has been litigated. As a result, the case is remanded for a litigation of all issues, liability and damages.
Okay. The reason I asked you about the Court of Appeals, I wasn't so sure what they were remanding it for, whether it was a full hearing, as if there was never any settlement agreement, never any previous arrangements.
I believe the settlement agreement is only binding as against Dominski and Arlington, and Arlington is now, of course, out of the case. Has been withdrawn as a party. So because of that, the settlement would essentially be of no effect as to all of the other parties to the litigation, including Image and its liability insurer.
Could I clarify, if somehow this went back and on the issue of damages there was only $1 million damages, what liability, if any, would Arlington have?
Image as Arlington's indemnitor or Arlington itself?
If Image is found to be viable as because of that, but the damages are only $1 million, does Arlington have any damages?
Arlington pays nothing. Image would pay whatever the settlement, whatever the judgment would be. But of course, recall that there are other parties to the case, and there would be an issue, conceivably, of comparative fault and contributory fault. So, whatever percentage of that judgment that Arlington was assigned would need to be paid by Image if the term is deemed to be valid by this court.
I asked your opposing counsel the hypothetical of what if it turns out that suddenly Image goes bankrupt and can't afford to pay the $1.4 million. Do you agree with his response that Arlington would not be responsible for anything?
That's exactly right.
And that is because part of the stipulation as part of the stipulation, Dominski agreed that he would not enforce any of this confessed judgment against Arlington. Am I correct on that or not?
That's exactly right.
What if that was not part of the equation here? What if Arlington and Dominski did not have that agreement? Would Arlington then be responsible?
Well, yes. I mean, what we have here is if all we had was the agreement to a settlement amount and just an assignment of the right for indemnity, we'd have a completely different situation.
I'm not trying to play hide the ball trick here. I'm not a law professor. The concern I have with his response, and I'm going to get back to him on rebuttal, is I was starting off this case thinking that of course there's incentive for Arlington, for a manufacturer to manufacture a safe product, and we allow the shifting of financial responsibility by insurance. That's a shifting of financial responsibility. So we allow a manufacturer to shift that financial responsibility via insurance. But then when he answered my question the way he did, I began to get concerned. Well, where is the financial incentive for Arlington to manufacture a safe product? Why don't they just sell, every time they sell a product, include one of these clauses and therefore never even have to insure themselves because it's always going to be on the other party? Do you agree with it? I guess I'm not making a whole lot of sense. I know what I think, but I can't. But I'm not sure that I'm imparting it. Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yes, and I believe that the only incentive that Arlington has is if the judgment, a settlement that it agreed to, or a judgment that was entered against it, if the indemnity provision didn't exist, would be not insuring itself, that it would be run out of business. Which is exactly why that indemnity provision is so troublesome, because even someone who chooses not to insure itself at least will be run out of business if they don't get to offload their liability to the purchaser of the product. That's not what we have here, and the situation where Arlington can provide that the sole source of the judgment and settlement that it agreed to is against the party, Image, who agreed to indemnify it, permits it to escape liability entirely and continue to operate its business. I'd like to address briefly the issue about delegation of duty versus shifting of financial responsibility. I've noticed throughout the briefing that when Dominski is quoting the provision from the back of the sales agreement that relates to indemnity, there's always ellipses in it. The full provision is quoted in our brief, and it's also in the appendix at page A72 if you want to look at it. But one of the things that's interesting about it is there are two paragraphs under buyer's indemnity of Arlington. The first one says warning, and the second one says hazard liability. And the first three sentences under warnings are deleted when Dominski quotes that provision because it isn't the actual indemnity language. The first three sentences are just not directly relevant to the true language that shifts that indemnification. But and the Court of Appeals picked up on that. The same quote appears in the Court of Appeals opinion. But I think if we're looking at this issue of shifting financial responsibility, which is something that we permit, versus actually delegating duty, it ends up being important. Those three sentences state, the items sold herein may be dangerous if improperly used. The buyer is warned and acknowledges that they must contact the original manufacturer to obtain up-to-date installation and operation manuals and other information to ensure safe operation of the goods sold. Seller will not be responsible for any loss or injury resulting from defects in the items sold or from the subsequent use of the items. It's the essence of a delegation of duty. What the seller is saying is, go find whoever first created this product. Go get the manuals. Go find out how it's supposed to be safely used. Now, immediately following that is the indemnity language that we've been fighting about this morning. But I think if we're talking about delegation of duty, this contract, if you look at the whole of the transaction and look at all of the language, it establishes that this is indeed a delegation of duty, which is prohibited under Wisconsin law.
Why is it so much a delegation of duty? Why are you arguing delegation of duty as at least it seems to me anyway, the argument, maybe it's just semantic, but the argument is that what they are doing is relieving themselves of obligation to manufacture a safe product.
Well, I think the whole idea of the concept of strict liability is we want the incentives to lie with a party that has control. And we'll permit shifting of financial responsibility. We want the incentives to remain where they are. And what I contend is that this is more than a shifting of financial responsibility. It expects Image to do what Arlington should, which is make sure that this product is safe and is used properly.
Is Image a... This question may not be on the mark, but is Image to be analyzed as a commercial, this is a commercial transaction with equal parties and equal status, or is Image, regard to products liability, the ultimate user and therefore consumer, even though it was done with a commercial contract?
Image is a commercial entity. It buys products to process plastic at its plant. But for the purposes of products liability, it is indeed a consumer in that its employees are using this machine, which is alleged to be unreasonably dangerous. And that is why we have been focusing on the delegation of duty, because it can't be on the shoulders of the party who purchases the product, whether they're a commercial entity or a consumer, to make sure that the product is safe. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I ask one other question? It's absolutely clear that Arlington is a manufacturer and not a reconditioner?
Well, Your Honor, for purposes of strict liability law, the claims against Arlington, and that's what we're dealing with here because this matter was resolved shortly after the pleadings on cross motions for summary judgment. The claim against Arlington was that it failed to properly design and sell a product. It was a defective design claim. It would be unfair simply because they're the second owner and seller of the product, but yet designed the safety feature that's at issue in the case, that they don't constitute a manufacturer for purposes of strict liability. That hasn't been contended by Davinsky here, that the strict liability laws don't apply to them as a manufacturer, and it certainly wasn't addressed by the Court of Appeals.
Would that be an issue if you should prevail on this second issue? If it went back, that there is no liability here at all by Arlington?
Because they had no responsibility in strict liability and tort? That certainly could be a defense, yes.
Mr. Ritchie?
In the few moments that I have, I'd like to...
If I may ask the question maybe a little bit different way. When I asked you if Image went belly up, became unable to pay, would Arlington have a responsibility to pay, you said no.
Correct.
All right. So I'm a manufacturer. Let's get it out of the way. I'm a manufacturer of products that I put into the marketplace. And I know that I am going to be held responsible for the safe production of these widgets. And so every time I sell a widget, I put into the contract with whoever is buying it that if in fact I should be sued, you, the buyer of the widget, are going to be held, are going to have to be financially responsible. You're going to take all of my financial responsibility, I'm going to take all my financial responsibility and shift it. Now, isn't that really a delegation of what, as a matter of public policy, we want to keep with the manufacturer?
No, because delegation is something different than that. Delegation means that you do not sue me, but we replace me with someone else in my stead, and that you sue them and I walk away. In this case, Arlington did not have the ability to do that when this lawsuit was begun. Davinsky,
I'm not talking about Arlington. I'm talking about a manufacturer. Why shouldn't, if we go your way, why shouldn't every manufacturer of a product insist in their sales contract that the financial responsibility for any unsafe product gets shifted away from me?
They could, and if buyers agree to it, they probably would. And if buyers refuse to do that, then they will look for some other means, which would probably be insurance. But even if you do that, okay, it doesn't mean that your company is now safe, because Davinsky sues Arlington. Davinsky can say, I don't give a hoot about whether you've got some side agreement with Image. I'm coming after you. And if you don't have the assets, I'm going to take your company down, but I'm going to take whatever I can. Arlington has the strength of that indemnity agreement, which may be worth nothing. And so they didn't ask for a financial statement from Image before they consummated the deal. And so the Image's hide is on the line to Davinsky, because if they can't enforce and they can't collect, then they are going down.
Maybe the indemnity agreement here in and of itself is no problem, but when employed in conjunction with a contractual provision that you cannot enforce any damages against us, Arlington is saying to Dominski, then there is no incentive for accountability at all. Dominski can't come against Arlington for any damages, and if there are damages, it got to be paid by Image.
But see, now we're
Then the consumer is out of luck.
But here, the consumer actually has a benefit, because the consumer has the chance to go after Arlington if the consumer wants to.
Not in this case.
No, yes, because Dominski could say, I don't care about, I'm not going to settle with that type of a stipulation.
But as the case is before us here, plaintiff agrees not to execute this judgment against defendant.
But what I'm saying is, before they got to that part of the settlement, Dominski was in the driver's seat to say, I can come after Arlington and just go after Arlington if I think Arlington's got the money. Or he can, through the advice of his attorney, can say, well, maybe there is another avenue, and that is having, we have the benefit of an additional layer, that there is additionally someone else who can provide financial resources in addition to Arlington. So given that, how do I want to negotiate a settlement? But if we were to strike down all indemnity agreements, all insurance policies for the purpose of trying to change behavior, first of all, I don't think that that changes behavior, but would we do the same for drivers or people who have dogs that bite, to say that you can't have insurance, or to say that in all of the contracts that go through construction, where everybody agrees to indemnify the next and the next and the next, all that is letting the free market work to try and find out where the cost can best be purchased or best be indemnified, so that it filters down. If this didn't work efficiently, then the marketplace will let that fan out. But the second issue was whether or not somebody has notice of the settlement, which has come up. And I think that when you look at this, when they tender the defense to Image and Image says no thank you, if you then have to invite them into the settlement discussions, it only gives the option to say I agree or I disagree. If they said I agree, then presumably they can never come back and challenge the settlement. And if they say I disagree, which we expect that every indemnitor would, but who's going to say, I see you're going to sue me, but I like the settlement? We could always assume that they would disagree with the settlement, which is the situation that we have here. Does that mean that they can now still come back and say, now you have to sue me and litigate the entire thing all over again? That seems to be the worst public policy, so that even though they didn't get any notice of the settlement, it's the same thing as if they were given notice and they just said, we disagree with it. Well, what is the indemnity supposed to do with that? I propose that you still have the freedom to go forward and settle even over their objection and enforce it under the provisions that we've talked about.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie, and thank you, Ms. Hansen, for the arguments in this.